Welcome back, everybody. I hope your Thursday afternoon is going well. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. As always and ever, we've got a very busy show for you this afternoon. At the top of the hour, I'll be joined by Dr. Kristen Lierley and climate scientist Tom DiLiberto. He used to work at NOAA. We'll be talking about the Texas floods. Could we have actually prevented these deaths? Were there early warning systems that because of the Doge billionaire overlord cuts didn't happen? Is Trump fundamentally putting communities in floodplains at risk by the dismantling of NOAA? We're going to get there this afternoon. And at 5:30, I'll be talking about fraud, waste, and abuse to the tens of millions right here in Wisconsin. You're not going to want to miss that. But right now, I'm joined by a prior guest from the Center for American Progress Action Fund, Mia Ives-Ruble. Thank you for taking the time this afternoon, Mia, and welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
Yes, I need folks like you. I think we all need folks like you to help us ground ourselves in the very real world impacts of the big, brutal bill. So let's jump right in there. The big, brutal bill took big, huge, nearly $1 trillion cuts to Medicaid. It is also going to end up hampering Medicare because of the deficit levels. This, in turn, is going to have some pretty devastating impacts for folks with disabilities. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and how that's going to operate on the ground?
Yeah, there's a big misnomer there's a lot of talking points that are going out there that are saying that they aren't cutting Medicaid and that they're going to keep Medicaid for the most disabled. But I think people need to understand that disability isn't a binary thing. You know, it's on a spectrum, and the people that they are talking about are people who have made it through the process of SSI or SSDI, which is a cumbersome process to go through, where you have to submit a bunch of medical documentations and prove that you are disabled enough to receive those services. And so there are a ton of disabled people who are not within that category. It's about 2.6 million adults who are not on SSI or SSDI and have difficulty working, right? And so when we talk about these quote-unquote work requirements, which are, they're really paperwork requirements. Yes. Because we know that a majority of people who are on Medicaid and aren't eligible for SSI or SSDI are currently working. And so they're working minimum wage jobs, jobs that don't provide health insurance. Only 8% of recipients between the ages of 19 and 64 aren't working. And that is mostly due to them either providing care to their parents or children. So, you know, when we're talking about what population they're talking about, it's a minuscule amount of people.
Again, that statistic is only 8% of Medicaid recipients aren't working, and most of those aren't working because of other care obligations. It's interesting to me that if they were really genuine about this, and of course they're not, you could do an analysis, you could audit Medicaid, you could follow up with that 8%. And if you wanted to be draconian about it, you would figure out the dollar value associated with that 8%, and that would be the cut. But that's not what they did, right? Like the fig leaf explanation is not in any way, shape, or form borne out by any data analysis, and I'm including data analyses that have been done by Cato and AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, which are incredibly conservative / libertarian leaning organizations. It just doesn't work. And this, I think, for folks with disabilities that may live outside of large urban areas with public transportation systems, with large other nonprofit services agencies, which can albeit completely inadequately, try to at least assist folks who may be at acute need and risk because of the brutal bill's devastating cuts. You start looking into rural communities, and even that inadequate safety net isn't there. Tell us a little bit more about why this is going to be so difficult and painful in rural communities.
Yeah, what people don't understand is that the dollar amount that is paid towards Medicaid, which is a portion from the federal government and then a portion from the states, they cover specific services. However, that money gets doled out to many different things, like paying for wages for the employees that are there, including, you know, the cleaning staff and folks who are, you know, doing the examinations, et cetera.
Yes.
And then you're also paying for buildings, right?
Yes.
And so when you talk about reducing the number of people who are eligible for Medicaid, when that proportion gets smaller, it puts a lot of stress on places like hospitals and clinics in rural areas. In 2025, there were about 2,086 rural hospitals that received about $12.2 billion a year of net revenue from Medicaid. That's about a median of $3.9 million a year for each hospital setting. And these hospital settings have the lowest operating margins,
yes,
in the country, right? And so they aren't making a lot of money, and many of them are losing money. And so what we found is that 44% of rural hospitals are operating in negative margins. And as a result, more than 300 rural hospitals are at immediate risk of closure, which means that individuals who are living in these rural areas that already have to drive a long way to get to a medical clinic. I know my parents have a place up in Maine, and it takes an hour to get to the closest hospital. It's going to take even longer for those individuals. And so there's places that don't have maternity care.
Yes.
There's places that don't have specific services for some of the most at-risk people. And these people are just going to have to travel even farther. And some of them don't even have the transportation to do that.
Yeah, that hence my setup of the question, trying to contrast folks that may live in more urban settings with those in rural settings. And I'm just going to restate what you just said in maybe a little bit of economist terms, because that's the way I think about it. If you live in a rural area and you have a rural hospital, it is highly likely that that rural hospital is receiving a large part of financial support from Medicaid. It is further possible that that, relative to hospitals in large urban areas, that that federal aid is going towards both physical plant and operating expenses, meaning it is essential for the continuation of services at that hospital. It's not only in paying for actual medical care, it is fundamental to the continuing operation of the hospital. Therefore, because rural hospitals rely so directly on Medicaid funding, and so many operate either at a loss or with extremely small revenue or net revenue margins, if they lose any federal funding because the federal government wants to require folks to fill out more paperwork, which if you're having problems, if you're living on the edge, your food or housing insecure, you're experiencing job loss, and you qualify for these programs, you take even a small portion of that away, you will definitely, not a question about it, lose rural hospitals. Have I said that fairly, Mia?
That
because
100%.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Please go ahead.
Yeah. I think it's also important to understand that Republicans put out this relief fund for rural hospitals, which is $50 billion. It sounds like a lot to begin with, But when you break it down with the number of rural hospitals there are, and the time period that this would be allotted, that would be about $4.5 million a year for each hospital. And these hospitals, again, are spending millions and millions of dollars already.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about this second point, which I don't think most folks who don't have a family member with a disability or are not themselves disabled in some way are completely unaware of. And that is the fact that federal law permits wage discrimination for disabled people. Explain why that is, or at least the purported justification. And frankly, the Trump's administration, their efforts to lock that wage discrimination in place for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, it's really interesting to watch because a lot of folks don't understand that this actually is directly related to some of the Medicaid cuts that we're seeing. So 14C is an antiquated policy that was put into the Fair Labor Standards Act, which was intentionally, I'm guessing they were trying to be good. They were trying to find ways to get people into the labor market that had significant disabilities. Unfortunately, what it has become, the project has become, is basically paying disabled people subminimum wages with no opportunities to move up. And they're working in these sweatshop-like conditions, in locations that are basically glorified warehouses, sticking things into envelopes and sorting things. So these aren't jobs that specifically are inspiring for these individuals. Nobody aspires to become
an envelope stuffer,
right? Yes. Yeah, exactly. And so during the Biden administration, what they did was they put out a rule, a proposed rule to eliminate 14C, and Trump has decided to roll that back.
And the Biden administration's elimination of 14C would have simply meant that disabled people in the workplace are also entitled to that glorious windfall, also known as minimum wage here in the United States, which is $7.25 an hour, which equates to an annual income of about $15,000 a year, which I am unaware of any human being on the planet that can survive. Well, not on the planet, I should not speak so blithely. I'm not sure that any American can subsist on $15,000 a year. Truly, truly shocking. Folks, we've been talking with Mia Ives-Ruble of the Center for American Progress Action Fund, disability advocate and friend of the show. Thanks so much, Mia. Please take care of you and yours. We'll talk again soon. When we come back, I'm going to be talking about Donald Trump's election data grab and the election data lawsuit proceeding in New York State. There's some weird statistical anomalies going on. What exactly should we be concerned about here? We discuss on the other side. I'm Maggie Dawn, and this is the Civic Media Radio Network.